Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
And this is about the fourth incident. And a public called on the president four times to publicly come out, renounce violence, and to assure our people that the central region where he comes from is open to campaign by any other political party.
Former Malawian presidents condemn violence at the ongoing voter registration centers.
The clue lies in key questions such as the approval of the president. But the direction of the country, 62% of voters say that Ghana is headed in the wrong direction, compared to 27% who say right direction. And then when you come to the approval of the president, 65% of them disapprove of his performance.
The latest opinion poll shows main opposition leader and former Ghanaian president John Dramani Mahama will win the presidential contest.
We have not gotten that signal from President Tinubu that he would not take the issue of corruption lightly. We are yet to get that signal.
And a Nigerian civil society group calls on President Bola Tinubu to take a firm public stand against corruption. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Malawi, three former presidents are demanding an independent investigation and subsequent prosecution against those involved in committing violence against protesters. The leaders also condemn the assault against demonstrators, saying it is unacceptable. The former president, including Bakili Muluzi, Joyce Banda, and Arthur Peter Mutharika, condemned the assault, saying they will not remain silent as the constitutional right of unarmed citizens are violated. This as armed individuals attack protesters who were unhappy with the chaos at the voter registration centers. It comes as the Electoral Commission compiles a voter list for next year's general election. Supporters of the governing Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, also condemned the violence and called for the prosecution of those involved. For more about the demands of the former heads of state, I reached Dr. Peter Arthur Mutharika. He's a former president and presidential candidate of the main opposition, the Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP.
So what happened was these people were demonstrating at the headquarters of the Malawi Electoral Commission against the attempts by the commission to bring in some equipment which is suspicious, and also mistakes in the registration by the National Registration Bureau. So they got permission to demonstrate. And when they were there, armed thugs, we believe, brought in trucks by the Malawi Congress Party, started attacking the people. And the police were there just watching, doing nothing. So we decided to condemn this because the Malawi Congress Party is instituting measures which are aimed at returning this country to the one-party state. And we simply are not going to accept that. That's why we issued that statement yesterday.
But Mr. President, some of your critics are saying during your presidency, members of your party, the DPP, targeted opposition people by attacking them. So you don't have the moral stance to condemn anything, but that you are just politicking at the moment. How do you respond to that?
I think they're talking about an incident that happened before I became president. I believe they're talking about 2011. I was not present then, when I think there was some kind of fracas between some supporters of the DPP and other political parties here in Blantyre. It's not one incident a long time ago, and it's being magnified for obvious reasons. It was not during my time as president, you see, before my time.
What are you demanding the police to do at the moment? Because I understand there's already an investigation underway.
No, there's no investigation. This is about the fourth time. For the last three incidents, when my party, our people demonstrating, and they are going to a function, and their vehicles were attacked, destroyed, And the people, one person died, and the police did nothing. And this about the fourth incident. And I publicly called on the president four times to publicly come out, renounce violence, and to assure my people that the central region where he comes from is open to campaign by any other political party. That's why this time we're calling on him again, the three of us, to come out and stop this kind of violence. He has the capacity to do so.
Some Malawians say that President Mutharika should be asked why he's condemning the violence, why his party supporters did the same in Blantyre when they openly wielded panga knives to disrupt demonstration by opposition parties. Why does he think he's relevant now? What's your response to that, Mr. President?
This is completely false. It's not 2019. As I said earlier, it was one incident in 2011 when our people were, I think, traveling in Blantyre, and the opposition party young people were also in the same place, and they clashed. There was confrontation between them. There was a fracas, and that was it. What I say now is a very different situation, where actually these thugs were transported from a town called Insundwe, outside Lilongwe, about 5 miles away, in five or six trucks, transported, and these were do not want any trucks. So obviously these trucks were provided by somebody else. And they transported into Lilongwe to attack the demonstrators, and the police did absolutely nothing. Instead, they started tear gassing our demonstrators. I mean, the whole thing is so ridiculous and pathetic that I don't see how anybody really can defend it. But then this is Malawi, where we have some people who are, whose minds are so twisted that they cannot see right and wrong. That's the problem having this country.
The question people are asking is, what will you do about politically related violence? Because it so happens that during elections or voter registration processes or period, these politically related violence seem to occur. What will you do to ensure that politically related violence is addressed in Malawi?
First of all, the leadership has to make it very clear that violence is not acceptable. And the police must do their job. And they arrest those people who are causing violence instead of just standing there and watching while people are being attacked. So the leaders must denounce violence, and the police must do their job instead of playing up to the ruling political party. That's what needs to be done. And that's what we have done in the past.
Arthur Peter Mutharika is a former Malawian president. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Blantyre. Namibian political parties are campaigning ahead of the coming November 27 presidential and legislative elections. Local media reports say the campaigns have been largely peaceful as the parties rally their supporters for their votes. Analysts say the political dominance of the governing SWAPO party is expected to be significantly tested this year. In the presidential contest, incumbent Vice President Netumbo Nandi Ndaitwa faces stiff competition from main opposition challenger Mark Henry Venani from the Popular Democratic Movement, or PDM, and Dr. Penduleni Itula from the Independent Patriots for Change, or IPC. For the latest development about the campaigns, I reach public policy analyst Marius Kudumo.
I think the campaigns have been going on well, peacefully, and the political parties have been all over Namibia trying to convey their messages. Obviously, it's only when voting takes place and the results are announced that we can see whether those messages have been resonating with the voters, with the citizens.
In your estimation, Dr. Kudumo, how do you see Namibians or prospective voters reacting to the messages?
Yeah, I think they are receiving it differently because elections are not an end in themselves. They are a means to an end. It is about whether the messages are addressing the real issues that are affecting the people. in terms of convincing them that the strategies and the plan will actually address their problem. The point that I'm trying to make is those that are in the urban areas, in the informal settlement, their challenges might be different from those in the remote and the rural areas. The challenges of the youth are not necessarily the same of the people that are working. So different people are receiving the messages differently. But like I said, we'll see actually in the outcome of the results how people have received the message and how they have responded.
One of the criticisms being leveled against SWAPO, the ruling party or the incumbent party, is that Namibia has not made significant strides in terms of the economy, in terms of youth employment, though the party has dominated Namibian politics since independence. And they think that Namibia should be better off and the resources managed better off. Do you think those criticisms are resonating and are fair?
Yeah, obviously, they will resonate depending on who is the target group. For example, social provisioning in terms of education. I think we have done reasonably well because the challenges now, especially with graduates, unemployability or graduates not finding employment, then obviously on the social factors in terms of the economy, I think at the initial stage we are doing well, but currently we are not doing well. And obviously the economy is linked to global factors and sources. But for the voters, those explanations are not sufficient. So I think people are feeling your average Namibian, your working class Namibian is feeling that their material conditions should have been better than what it is now, irrespective of what the explanation is. So obviously, there will be voters who will think that the governing party should have done better in some areas than the current state.
Some opposition parties have questioned the award of contract to a South African-based or Johannesburg-based company to print ballot papers. They are even wondering that the award of contract was shady and that that could even taint the credibility of the election and that the Electoral Commission was not transparent. What are your thoughts?
I think there are some valid merits, but I don't think that it will impact necessarily on the election. The issue is we have a procurement process in the country that is defined in a law, the Procurement Act. And the provision there is open bidding, both nationally and internationally. There is also an emergency type of acquiring goods and services. The Electoral Commission have opted for open bidding and they have advertised that service. 2 days before the closure of that bidding, they change and go for emergency procurement. They might be valid reason for that, but they have not intelligently and convincingly explained why they changed.
Marius Kudumo is a public policy analyst. He spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek. In Ghana, the latest opinion poll shows main opposition leader and former President John Dramani Mahama will win the presidential contest in the coming December 7 general election. The outcome of the findings show Mahama won't win with 52%, followed in second place by incumbent Vice President Muhammadu Bawumia with 41.3%. Conducted by Global Info Analytics and a crowd-based research group, the research shows that prospective voters are concerned with major factors such as the economy, jobs, education, infrastructure, and the direction of the country. For more details about the latest research, I reach Musa Dankwa. He is the executive director and head of global research at Global Info Analytics.
This is the fifth of our weekly tracking polls. 35% of the sample were self-identified NPP voters, and 33% are self-identified NDC voters, with 18% being floating voters, or what we call the independent voters, and 3% other parties with another 11% who wouldn't tell us which party they support. Now, at the end of the survey, John Mahama is on 52%, Dr. Mahmoud Bawumia on 41.3%, Alan Chiramartin on 2.3%, Nana Bediako on 4.1%, and their other candidates 0.4%.
What were some of the key indicators for which reason these responded attributed to their choice of who will become Ghana's next president?
The clue lies in key questions such as the approval of the president, but the direction of the country. 62% of voters say that Ghana is headed in the wrong direction, compared to 27% who say right direction. And then when it comes to the approval of the president, 65% of them disapprove of his performance. Only 28% approve of his performance. When it comes to the government as a whole, 49% disapprove or say they perform poorly or very poor. Now, if you ask them about their economic condition, 28% said it's gotten better in the last 12 months. 21% said that it's the same. But 51% said their personal economic condition has gotten worse in the last 12 months. Now, when you ask them about the three key issues that matter to them, as far as the election is concerned, you have the economy on 75% of mentions, jobs on 69%, and education on 52%. So the top three issues are the economy, jobs, and education.
But you know, some supporters of the ruling New Patriotic Party have dismissed the poll as set up by the opposition just to make the government unpopular ahead of the election. How do you respond to that?
Look, we've been doing polling for the past 6 years. Indeed, our polls were the last to come out in 2020, before the election. And that was spot on with regards to what the outcome would be. We've done so over the period. In primaries, of the MPP primaries, we've done so in by-elections. We are a private company that does poll as part of our business object. We've not been set up by any organization to do any sentimental polls.
Now, so the question is, are these prevailing issues the reason why the ruling party presidential candidate is weighed down due to economic issues, due to jobs or unemployment, for example?
Right. Largely so, because if you look at the data, people who say that economy is their number one issue, who are they voting for? If you look at people who say economy is their priority, 54% of them are opting for John Mahama and 40% for the vice president. For those who say job is key for them, Mahama is leading 53%, Bawumia 41%. Those who say education is key to them, Mahama is on 50%, Bawumia 45%. So you can see that clearly on those three issues, Mahama's upper hand. Again, beside those economic issues, you have two members or two candidates who are running independent, who are dragging the numbers from the ruling party. Alan Chiramartin, the Movement for Change leader, he is doing well in areas that MPP should be doing well. Ashanti region, Eastern region, Bulu East and Central region and Western region. And then also Nana Kwame Bediako, the young candidate who is attracting younger voters, is doing well in the same places MPP needs to do well. At the moment, he is doing more than 5% in the Ashanti region. And that is a problem for MPP.
Musa Dankwa is the executive director and head of global research at Global Info Analytics. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. In Nigeria, a civil society group is calling on President Bola Tinubu to take a firm public stand against corruption by stating his commitment to end graft and wrongdoing. The Center for Social Justice says the president's anti-graft stance will significantly boost the fight against corruption. It comes as civil society and opposition groups complain about corruption in public institutions, which they argue takes away resources to be used to improve the lives of citizens. For more on the call in the fight against graft, I reach Victor Emujuewe. He is the Monitoring Evaluation Strategic Communication Manager at the Center for Social Justice.
We know Nigeria has a very big issue of corruption because the resources that is available in the country is enough to take people out of poverty. It's enough to give people good life. But currently, Nigeria ranks amongst the worst governed country in the world, with 133 million persons living in abject poverty. Not because we don't have the resources, but because privileged few in government that have access to these resources are not using it transparently and accountable, you know, to meet the needs of Nigerians. But previous governments, like Obasanjo, when he came in, he saw the need to fight corruption, and he began to set up some reformable policies, like the Public Procurement Act, the Fiscal Responsibility Act. Those were laws that helped us to save some money.
Victor, some are arguing that making a statement against corruption is not as important as taking concrete actions and steps and implementing reforms to prevent corruption or graft.
You know, in this part of the world, when you make a statement, it is seen as your policy direction. A lot of agencies respond to presidential statements. Take, for instance, the statement that subsidy is gone. That statement was made at the point of inauguration. And almost immediately, the prices of petrol changed. When Buhari took office, he has this anti-corruption posture. As soon as he was inaugurated, a lot of people that were not coming to work early as at that time, they started reporting as early as 7 o'clock in the morning.
Victor, previous leaders, they said, have made firm commitment and pledges to combat corruption or graft, only for Nigerians to realize that their commitment were just mere lip services, like you mentioned the case of President Buhari. What say you about this?
So, yes, Buhari had this anti-corruption posture. People saw him as someone with integrity, but unfortunately, he was not able to live up to the standards that were expected of him. And so a lot of people in his cabinet, they perpetrated graft, fraud, and he was not able to muster the political will to push through his reforms. However, he introduced very good reforms, such as the Open Government Partnership, which he signed on to. He encouraged the beneficial ownership. He also introduced the whistleblower policy, which I didn't think we have the political will that is backing these policies. These are policies that are enough to reposition Nigeria onto the path of transparent government for Nigerians.
So are you saying that these remedies that you have expressed are the key issues that could help fight or reduce corruption in public life in Nigeria?
Yes. Everybody is looking up to the leader. So people are looking up to the leader of a country to determine how they function, to determine how they will remain in the norm, if they will remain continuing the norm, or if there will be some changes. So we've not gotten that signal from President Tinubu that he would not take the issue of corruption lightly. We are yet to get that signal.
Victor Emeju Iwe is the Monitoring Evaluation Strategic Communication Manager at the Center for Social Justice. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Tanzania, a new poll shows citizens approve of the government's management. The study was conducted by Afrobarometer on behalf of Ripoa, a Tanzanian NGO research firm. The findings show that 67% of respondents say they approve of the administration's handling of the economy. They also show that 53% say their living conditions have improved. Donald Murray is the executive director of Rapport. He tells me that the research also shows that the positive economic outlook was tied to improvement in infrastructure and national security.
Well, you can see that the economy is growing, a much significant reversal from post-COVID or during the COVID era. And the inflation is declining, meaning that key things that worry people seems to be easing on them. And that's really the basis of the feeling that the Tanzanians have. I think you can see also the rate of investment increasing. Possibly that opens up opportunities for people, small and medium enterprises. It's not quite where we want to be, but I think there are signals that things are changing. And I think that's what we can interpret it to be.
Looking at the improved economic outlook per the research, does improvement in infrastructure and national security have direct impact into what you are seeing now as a result of the research?
It's very obvious. When you have improved infrastructure, including an electricity supply, railways and more roads being opened up, I think it's easing transport haulage. I think even in the ports, turn around at the port, I understand it's improving. So the cargo flow is much easier. So business is opening up, and I think that that has to do with the outcomes in terms of declining prices. Inflation is slowed down. Probably additional investments that are creating additional jobs, but opening up opportunities also for SMEs to, you know, begin to trade more easily. I think that's a totality of those outcomes, I think, has contributed to that positive outlook of the people.
What about the living standards of the people? Are they comparing an improved living standards to the improved economic outlook per the survey?
Yeah, you can see that when we ask people about their living condition in 2022, 54% were saying it was bad or very bad. But the current survey, 2024, that has declined to 38% from 54%. And those that are saying their condition is good has also increased from around 31% to 39%. So that's about 9 percentage point increase. So you can actually see that direct correlation between infrastructure investment, easing environment for investment, investment climate and business environment. Although they are definitely contributing to the outcome that we are seeing also in terms of their living condition.
Overall, what do you think is the major takeaway following this research?
The major takeaway is that ongoing reforms are important. They are producing outcomes, both reforms but also investments in the infrastructure that reduces cost of business, increases economic efficiency. The government should continue to do that. And I can say that should this continue, the future of Tanzania is very bright. And I think it's going to attract more investment that we need to help sustain the growth momentum that we are seeing now. But of course, along with these reforms, we need to ensure that this growth becomes more inclusive so that the economic condition and the living condition of the majority of the people continues to improve.
Donald Murray is the executive director of Rapport. He spoke with me from the Tanzania commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. A Ugandan journalist is expressing excitement after a high court ordered compensation from the government following an assault by soldiers of the National Army, the Uganda People's Defense Forces, or UPDF. Two journalists, Timothy Murungi and Henry Sekanjako from the state-run New Vision Media Group, were assaulted by soldiers while covering a protest led by main opposition leader Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine. The attack occurred as the opposition leader presented a petition protesting right violations to the UN Human Rights Office in the capital, Kampala, in 2021. In its ruling, the court ordered the government to pay each journalist about $20,000 due to what it says were the psychological and physical harm they suffered due to the assault. For more reaction about the court's decision, I read journalist Henry Sekanjako.
We have been in court for 4 years, and this took us by surprise. First of all, we expected the case to be, you know, ruled on as soon as we filed, but it took some bit of time and we were worried. So when the judgment came through, we were excited, not because of the money, but because justice has prevailed. Because many journalists in Uganda have been beaten, they've been brutalized many times, and they just go like that, and the perpetrators have not been, you know, brought to book. And it set a precedent. I mean, this is the first time we are seeing, you know, court coming out to award journalists, you know, to rule in their favor. But the fact that a court was able to, you know, to find that those that, you know, beat us are responsible and they were held responsible for. And you pray that the Ugandan courts keep on doing the same. When journalists, when their rights are, you know, violated, they come out and defend them the way they did. It was a very exciting moment for us. And
Harry, I'm sure you've heard from some of your other colleagues in other media organizations in Uganda. Do you think that this ruling would encourage them to also seek legal redress in court if such is meted out to them? Because, like you said, others have suffered similar fate, but nothing happened.
Exactly. And when we were beaten, we were about 13 of us. But only two of us persisted. We said we have to, you know, to go to court, and the courts ruled in our favor. You know, let justice be done. Because most of them have, you know, decided not to go to court because they have a feeling that courts will not decide in their favor. But this gives them an example that courts can, you know, can rule in their favor. So they shouldn't sit and relax when they're beaten. They shouldn't, you know, just sit and give up on, you know, on their rights. They should go to court and, you know, seek redress. So I'm sure that this is setting a very good precedent for them. When their rights are being abused, when they're being violated, they should come out and go to courts of law. I'm sure they'll get justice, just like we did.
Harry, some people are suggesting that it's because you work for a state media organization, that is why the court was lenient, even after 4 years, because some people have attempted and they did not get any positive result at all. How do you respond to them?
I wouldn't say that's because that, you know, I was working for New Vision, which is a government entity. Our courts are very fair, because this case was open. We were beaten. There was evidence. There was, even when you look at the judgment, the justice has looked at the evidence that we gave to the courts, and it was true. We were beaten. The pictures were there. Everything was there. So it's not that we're working for a government media house that, you know, we were able to get justice. Like any other journalist in Uganda, they can be able to get justice as long as there's evidence to show that, you know, their rights were violated, they were beaten. It's not that because we're working from a government media entity.
Harry Sekanjako is a Ugandan journalist. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Guinea-Conakry, a coalition of political parties and civil organizations are urging the military to join the public to demand the departure of the ruling military junta if it fails to return the country to civilian rule by December 31st. For VOA reporter Karim Kamrama has more from the Guinean capital, Conakry.
In a strongly worded declaration, the coalition of political parties and civil society groups accused the military junta, particularly junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya, of instilling terror among Guineans. They also say Doumbouya has indicated he plans to hold on to power beyond December 31st, when he promised to return the country to democratic rule. Abdul Sako, spokesman of the coalition civil society organizations, says until Doumbouya announces he won't run in future election marking the end of the transition, the coalition will continue to call for his eviction from power by January 1st.
La première de ça, d'abord, une déclaration officielle du général Mamadi Doumbouya qui viendrait
He says the people want to hear an official declaration by junta leader Mamadi Doumbouya, reiterating his promise that neither him nor any member of the transition will be a candidate in future elections. He said what's also important is to include in the new constitution an article which states that the charter of the transition remains superior only throughout the period of the transition. Sako says the coalition is also demanding the release of all political prisoners and an end to the ban on public political demonstrations and permission for three most popular private broadcasters, which were shut down by the junta nearly a year ago, to resume operations. According to Edward Zotomo, spokesman of the opposition, they are open to negotiations to pave the way out for the junta's departure, but December 31st is a hard deadline marking the end of the transition.
Extension of the transition, that's going to be a no-go. I just don't see the opposition giving the CNRD that type of leeway. What we're saying again is we will be willing to talk. Of course, you can never say you don't negotiate, but you negotiate, it depends on the terms of the negotiation. If they ask you to come and negotiate just to give them a blank check to continue and carry out what they have already been doing, at that time we will draw the necessary conclusion. Today, Guinea look like a sleeping volcano. The top is hard, you think there's nothing. Beneath, boiling.
The coalition has called on the Guinean army to join the public on the 1st of January to demand the junta withdraw from power if it continues to hold on to power. The statement goes on to accuse the military junta of grave human rights violations, widespread corruption, and bad governance. The charter of the transition bans Doumbouya from standing as future candidate, but political analysts say if the new constitution is adopted in referendum at the end of the year, the junta leader will be eligible to run. With no sign that the junta is willing to yield power to a civilian-run government, some residents in the capital say they are preparing to leave for fear of violence. Others say they are beginning to stockpile food at home. The religious leaders have called on both sides for calm and urged the military junta to open immediate, unconditional, and inclusive talks with all political and civil society actors. All key opposition leaders have since fled the country for fear of arrest by the military. Attempts to get a response from the authorities connected to the military junta were unsuccessful. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
An estimated 8 million voters in Chad go to the polls December 29 in legislative, local and district elections. Female leaders and activists, however, say women candidates are being underrepresented. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka has more from neighboring Cameroon on the vote.
Mesdames et messieurs, chers candidates, chers candidats, conformément.
Chadian officials say the legislative elections will mark an end to a three-year transition from military to civilian rule that began when General Mahamat Idriss Déby seized power in April 2021 following the death of his father, long-serving President Idriss Déby Itno. During the transitional period, Déby said he would make sure women, who constitute more than 51% of Chad's population, were nominated in legislative, provincial and district elections. He said Chad would respect its pledges as a signatory to the Maputo Protocol, a commitment by African nations through the African Union to ensure gender equality in political decision-making. But activists say women constitute just over one-third of the candidates in this year's races, in which 180 political parties have nominated more than 8,500 candidates. They say limiting women from elective positions prohibits a majority of the Central African state civilians from participating in their country's development and legislating and voting on laws that will improve living conditions. Ahmed Bachiret, president of ANCH, Chad's National Elections Management, acknowledges the low number of women running for elected offices.
Avec un taux global de participation de 34,61%.
Bachiret says women constitute less than 35% of the list of nominees submitted by political parties, including Déby's Patriotic Salvation Movement, or MPS, for the December 29 elections. Ange also acknowledges that some nominations, including those of women, were turned down, but give no further details. Ange says anyone whose nomination was rejected can take up the issue through the courts. Women's groups, including the Association of Indigenous Women and People and the Civil Society Group Against Injustice and Equality, said in a release that Ange rejected nomination papers of women candidates who could not pay the roughly $250 application fee. Activists, however, say some political parties are still very reluctant to nominate women at times, claiming that women are not educated enough to occupy political office. Amina Priscille Longo is Child Minister of Women and Child Protection. Speaking Wednesday on state television, she noted that in some communities, there is resistance to women seeking higher office. Longo says Debbie's strong political will to involve more women in politics is facing opposition from communities, traditional rulers, and some clerics who think that women should stay at home to take care of their husbands and children. She says Debbie has ordered that a mass education campaign be carried out to advocate for the respect of women's rights and political participation. Longo also said many women lack the financial means to run in elections. Some Chadian women have complained that Prime Minister Alamaye Halina, whom Debbie appointed on May 23 as part of a new civilian government, has reduced the number of female ministers from 12 to 8. Activists say the government has not respected a resolution of the Central African Nations 2022 Inclusive and Sovereign National Dialogue, which states that more women should be appointed to government positions. Female leaders say women constitute the majority of Chad's population and can have more influence than men in peacekeeping processes. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And right now it's time for music from African Collection.
maman chante avec le sorcier Bantou. Je n'ai pas du boulot, ah papa, je suis toujours au chômage. Président Bamba, papa m'a payé les études, j'ai eu mes diplômes, je même fait des formations, mais je n'ai pas du boulot, ah maman, je suis toujours au chômage. L'humanité, la maman des artistes. Je fais des milliers de demandes pour chercher du boulot. Il y a toujours des rendez-vous, mais jamais du travail. Quand j'étais à l'école, je rêvais être médecin. Si c'est pas médecin, je voulais devenir docteur. Aujourd'hui, j'ai eu tous mes diplômes. Il y a toujours pas du boulot. C'est encore papa qui me donne l'argent du loyer. C'est toujours maman qui me dépend l'argent de poche.
Donnez-moi un peu de boulot.
Mais je vais bosser.
Moi aussi je veux travailler.
Moi je veux travailler.
Donnez-moi un peu de boulot.
Abel Singa.
Moi aussi je veux travailler.
Jean-Philippe Tamba, Ambroise Fondi, le duo de choc. L'école en Afrique n'a plus de valeur. L'école au Cameroun n'a plus sa valeur, et maman, même si tu es diplômé, tu ne vas pas travailler. Et même si tu es qualifié, tu seras toujours au chômage. J'ai perdu tout espoir, Belgio. Donne-moi n'importe quoi, pourvu que moi je travaille. Maman, pour que je ne meure pas de faim. C'est moi le directeur général de la société camerounaise de chômage, Chomaka. J'ai déjà recruté 5 millions de jeunes demandeurs et je recrute 24 heures sur 24. Mes futurs chômeurs des universités de Sowa, de Gaoundéré, de Bouéa, de Tchao, de Douala et de Yaoundé 1, je vous attends. À Chomaka, il n'y a pas de fin de dossier. Boulot c'est boulot,
y'a plus de choix.
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 Si tu peux laver les voitures,
c'est ça le boulot.
Si tu peux faire tomber un cyclone,
c'est toujours le boulot.
Tu peux vendre tes fruits et tomber,
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Mpuga and engineer the great Tiang Wang. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if the owner of the calabash calls it useless, others will join him to use it to gather rubbish. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa. Oh,